we don't have to agree on everything about the Kennedy assassination, but we can agree that when we have an event like that, that we investigate it, that we put people in to control the crime scene, that we maintain the chain of custody of evidence, that we investigate the suspects, the most likely people, the people who benefited. Let's check on them. What were they doing? So I am hopeful that things are changing in America, that there's a great deal of suspicion and there's a great deal of anxiety. Now, the danger is that we have rulers who are going to turn on us for being suspicious. This guy, Cass Sunstein, who was a Harvard lawyer and was appointed as head of the Office of Information by President Obama, was calling for the infiltration of conspiracy theory groups and networks in a respected journal article. And if he's thinking like that, you can be sure that there are people inside the military and intelligence apparatus that are quite alarmed with the fact that people are waking up in America. They're beginning to connect the dots. They're beginning to see the rampant corruption that has come since the Kennedy assassination, and especially since 9/11.
Well, I can only hope that if one of those employees of the government is stuck listening to these shows week after week to make a report, I hope they start to question what they're really doing. You know, I heard that happen.
You know, there's a real possibility for that. If you look back at Ellsberg, he was a CIA analyst. He was totally committed to the Vietnam War. He started going to anti-war demonstrations because he liked a girl there, a woman. And he converted. It opened his mind. He says he had a nervous breakdown, in effect, when he came to the realization of what was going on, that the government he had served so long was fighting an illegal war, and was, you know, just a terrible force for bad.
I think in your book you mentioned that the anecdote about Nixon telling the South Vietnamese president to pull out of the peace talk process because it would help him win the election, and then after the election, we'll get back on with it. So, you know, how many people died during that time just so Nixon could get reelected? Or, you know,
as many as died before 68. As many people died after Nixon did that as had died in the war. So it was 25, 30,000 soldiers' lives were lost, not to mention, you know, the horrific bombing of North Vietnam and Hanoi and the secret wars in Laos and Cambodia. This was not the end of Nixon's culpability, but the very beginning of it. And the blood is on his hands. By the time he died, he was at the funeral and everything, people talked pretty positively of him. He should be considered one, you know, like Pol Pot or somebody like that. I mean, he's like a genocidal character, the kind of the loss of life, not to mention the betrayal of the democratic process in America and our government and our values.
Well, the problem is when you salute the commander in chief and you think you're, you know, pledging allegiance to the flag and holding up the Constitution, you're thinking you have to equate these as being equal. And how could you have a president that would order you to his death, to your death, just so he could win the next election?
Yeah.
So how many people gave their lives for that? And he's, the domino theory and all that joke. I mean, the whole war was, as you go on to explain, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, another false flag operation. They just got their buddies in that they wanted to get oil off, Bell Helicopter and Joint Chiefs of Staff. And this whole thing of, you talked about the Soviet Union falling. I almost think that they went bankrupt and they just couldn't extend anymore. They were so far overextended in this arms race that America keeps saying, we will just outspend them, and we'll just keep spending, and we'll do Star Wars, and we'll do anything that when they finally go bankrupt, the war will end without a shot. Now, you could be on that insider's point of view saying, this is good. We'll alleviate having a thermonuclear war. We won't have World War III. Let's stick with the plan. And then, you know, if that's the plan and you think that's the best, and Kennedy says, I'm ending the Cold War now. I'm putting in a hotline, and I'm not going to believe the estimates by the, quote, CIA that, you know, are always right. inflated. I'm going to talk to the guy myself. And here he is making
Kennedy,
secret deals
Kennedy
with Castro.
Kennedy was the last president to stand up to these people. Truman fired MacArthur. Truman had the civilian control of the military was very iffy after World War II. Then Truman actually recruited Eisenhower to run for president because he thought that MacArthur was going to come back, and MacArthur did come back and run for president but didn't get the nomination and didn't go anywhere. But Eisenhower becomes president, and he has an enormously difficult time with the military. He's trying to cut the spending for the military, and his military commanders went to Congress and complained publicly about it. It was unheard of. And here, this guy had been the general of the forces in Europe. I mean, he was, if anybody could deal with the military, it would have been Dwight Eisenhower. Well, Kennedy comes in and tries to assert himself. He is assassinated, and that's the end of it. There is, you know, when Clinton did Don't Ask, Don't Tell, this was a policy on gays in the military, and a fairly modest change in some ways to their policies. And the big issue was, well, is the military going to go along with it? And isn't this very, uncertain how they're going to respond and so on? Well, that shows you where we stand in terms of the military being controlled by the civilian elites. They're pretty much doing what they want to do and what their plans are. And whoever's president, so I think from their point of view, this is just a person that's going to be here for a few years, and they have already got the agenda set and the policy set, and there's very little the president can do.
Well, I enjoyed your book. I think it's worthwhile reading. I encourage everyone to get it who's interested. I'll make a link to the book. Where is it available right now? The University of Texas?
University of Texas Press, and it's on Amazon. It's got a... and they're selling it. Amazon's selling it for like $13. So it's a really reasonable price. I think the University of Texas Press deserves a lot of credit. And Mark Crispin Miller, who was the editor of this series, they deserve a lot of credit for being willing to support my ideas and getting them out there. And they been marvelous support and help, and I think they really want the book to do well and sell, and that's out of Texas. that's where Lyndon Johnson comes from. That's where George Bush comes from. So these people are pretty gutsy.
Well, you know, when you get the Bill O'Reillys and people scoffing at 9/11, and I really enjoyed that you found the history of the word conspiracy theory and traced it through the American press and tied it back to the JFK assassination. And there was an awful lot of research here in the Kennedy assassination, which I'm familiar with. So it's very refreshing to read someone writing about this, that, you know, through your firsthand knowledge of the Florida elections has said that there is something wrong. Look at what has been discovered by the Warren Commission themselves, a jaded commission, but look at their report. The two don't even meet in the middle. I mean, it's just
right.
A cover-up by design. We know Earl Warren did not even want to take part. LBJ and the people who ordered him to have it, and, from day one, there was people who said LBJ's behind it. I mean, look who benefited, right?
Look who benefited. Well, you know, that CIA memo that went out to all the offices around the world and telling them to contact their media assets and plant this term conspiracy theory and discredit anybody who raises
right.
questions about it.
Number 1035 something, right?
Right, yeah. 1035-960.
Right.
Well, they said in there that people suspected Johnson. That was, and it looks like they monitor public opinion through a network of people who contact opinion leaders and just talk to them. But they said that there were people were hinting that Johnson was the the guilty party here because he did benefit. So, to some extent, that's a credit to the American people. That they looked at it and they said, that's the guy who benefited. That's who we should suspect. They didn't all swing right in there, but pretty quickly. I mean, it's pretty quickly you had public opinion rejecting the Warren Commission and fingering Johnson for this. And the American people did that. The conspiracy theory epithet, the conspiracy theory label that's used to discredit people and silence them, that's a norm, a term that the political elites use. They use it to silence people because the broad citizenry, the American people, have enough sense to where they start asking questions about this, and increasingly they're asking more questions about it. And I should ask you sometime to tell me how you came to your awareness of all these things, because people don't know these things immediately. It takes some exposure to events, and I think that they're personal for everybody. That we've all got our own stories, but they're grounded in our common sense.
Yeah, common sense and research. Now, I had the good fortune to write a letter to Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who answered it, and we became very close. And Fletcher was one of the few people who actually worked in the Pentagon in that line of work at that time. So when he started, in 1955, retired January 1st, 1964, when he'd had enough of it, I think that revelations he made to me are what caught my eye, and I decided to go further with it, because it's kind of like a bottomless pit of information. I mean, you start figuring out about, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and who would have planned this, and if Ed Lansdale, who did this for a living, there's a picture of him in Dealey Plaza in plain clothes.
Yeah,
and he retires October 31st, November 1st, something like that. That's when he retired from his, quote, Air Force job, right, when he was actually CIA all the time. And then you see him in Dealey Plaza, and a week before at the Hotel Texas. It opens you up, and you can't really go back. So then you look, well, what further would these guys have done? And you stumble across the, Northwoods.
Yeah.
And you said, are you kidding me? They would blow up a plane. They would, and then it goes on and on. I mean, I did an interview with April Oliver for CNN. She did this report on there was these missions in Vietnam where they found a lot of American defectors had left, and they were afraid of these defectors living on their own with the natives. They knew the tactics, so they went, we have to go and wipe them out. Let's just wipe the whole village out. And we'll spray. I mean, it's unbelievable, and you find more and more.
Yeah, Project Phoenix. I mean, I didn't know about that until I was in the service. I wasn't in Vietnam, but I was in the service and served in Germany during the Vietnam era. And
I'm talking about Tailwind.
Well, when I learned about Phoenix, where they'd done assassination programs, that was news to me, and just a terribly shocking thing, because they killed 20,000 to 40,000 people on grounds of suspicion, and just summary executions after torturing them.
And mayors and professors and teachers, and and you think this is what we're doing for the benefit of another country? Leave them alone. And of course you find out it's always oil or tungsten or some mineral they want there.
That is the amazing thing. I read the WikiLeaks, or some of them. I mean, there's so many you can't read them all, but that was the amazing thing to me. It was all about business. I realized that our government is the muscle for capitalism. That's what we do. We go in and negotiate and push people around, and if they don't respond, if they try to lock up their natural resources like oil, or they try to organize their people into unions, or they, God forbid, elect a leftist government, what our government does is go in there and undermine them and get rid of them. If they don't kill them outright, they get rid of them in another way.
If you don't believe that, you should read Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Yes. Yep. Yes. We're fortunate. There's a lot of this has come out and we've got a long time perspective on it, and a lot of resources. A lot of work has gone into it. You have done Yeoman's work, and Jim DeEugenio, and Lisa Pease, and I mean there's a huge list of people that have contributed to this. But now we stand atop their shoulders, and we can look out and see the terrain and what America has become, and have a much more realistic understanding of what our government is. That, you know, we believe in the flag and it's democracy and we're a force for good in the world and so on. Well, the reality is very different. And like you say, some research is necessary to inform yourself about these matters, and every American citizen has a responsibility as a citizen to inform themselves about it. You know, when we tried the Nuremberg war crimes trials in Nuremberg, part of that was to educate the German people that they had a responsibility to not let Hitler come to power. Hitler had manipulated them they got a law passed that said that you didn't have to have a law passed by parliament, it could be done by the cabinet. And this was what launched Hitler onto his terrible crimes. Well, we tried them, hung them, and the intent was to educate the German people. You had a responsibility not to allow this to happen. Well, the American people have a responsibility to the world and to themselves and to their country to have forthright leadership that stands for our values and doesn't betray our values. And right now we don't have that. And it doesn't matter who's president. It doesn't matter if it's a George W. Bush or Barack Obama. Apparently it doesn't matter. These people get elected to change. But Obama said he was going to change things. Clinton said he was going to change things. It doesn't change. It's bigger than them. So we've really got to put our heads together and form a consensus that things need to change fundamentally in the country. And the starting point is these crimes and hold people accountable for them. Once we do that, the whole thing, I think, will restore itself, that we would get democracy again, because what we've got right now is really a subversion of democracy through crime.
When speaking to Aaron Russo, I called America a democracy, and he corrected me very quickly and said, no, it's a republic. So
yeah,
we're in the illusion.
Yeah, people say that, and people have said that about my term, state crimes against democracy. But they understood it as popular control of government and the spirit of popular control of government. And the terms that the founders used were clearly looking at, we would call it representative democracy, but clearly it was intended to be that the government would serve at the pleasure and with the consent of the people. And today what you have is a government that is above the people and who looks at the people as a threat, who see them as, if they are suspicious, this is a bad thing. If they think that Johnson was behind the Kennedy assassination, we need to manipulate the press to change their minds and plant these words like conspiracy theory and ridicule anybody who raises these issues. We've really got the opposite of what the founders envisioned.
Okay, Lance, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, and I hope to promote your book through this interview. Encourage people to get it. It's worthwhile reading, and it really does illuminate the idea that our political research has been belittled by a tactic of the press to label anything as a theory and not research and not anything based on fact. And, you know, in the research community, there's people that disagree, and so that's one stumbling block. But you would think by education and seeing the problems that we'd be able to, you know, for our next generation, a better way and just as those people did with the Constitution, that they said that we have problems with England and a tyranny.
And they overthrew it, and they said that they had a responsibility to future generations and to themselves to overthrow the government that was plotting against them. That's exactly what they said, that there was a plot against their liberties, and that they could declare a new government as a result. Now, they didn't just willy-nilly go out and, you know, commit crimes and, you know, start a government out of nothing. They had a system and a tradition of local government and popular control of government. And I think we have those resources today, and we can correct this and re-energize our Constitution. I really appreciate you bringing me on your show, and I appreciate your kind remarks about the book. I'm excited about it, and I'm excited about talking to people who have studied this very carefully. And I learn, like you do, every day, some little new thing that I didn't know. It's a really, for a scholar and a social scientist, it's a pretty rich area of research.
Well, there are so many awful books coming out and awful documentaries that we just like to make sure that we cover some things that are in the right direction. And, you know, a book discussing conspiracy theory in America is overdue. You know, when you think of that ass Sunstein, I'll refer to him as, right?
Yeah, okay. I'm amazed at that article of Sunstein's. It was two Harvard lawyers, and it's like, how could they get into this and not see the flawed logic they had? But they said that conspiracy theories in America cannot be true because it would come out. Somebody would talk and so on. And how naive. The Manhattan Project. I mean, they kept that secret. That was a huge thing. 100,000 people were involved, and that never got out.
Well, government just ask Blakey secrets. About George Joannides, you know?
Yep, that's right. That's right.
Okay, is there anything else you might have wanted to bring up about the book I didn't get to?
One item, I'm trying to name some of these things. I think it's important to name things. And I'm starting to call the system of government, the way the elites are running it, selective totalitarianism. The idea is we're not a totalitarian state where the government is constantly controlling all of our information or everything that we do, but the government is setting off events or letting events happen or conjuring attacks or provoking attacks that are very important and set the future agenda for us. So 9/11 gets us off into this war on terror. Our country changed. Our civic culture changed after 9/11. And that was this kind of event. We don't know entirely what happened, but we know that there were warnings, that nothing was done. The American people were not warned. The anthrax letter attacks occurred shortly thereafter, and the White House was taking Cipro to prevent anthrax infections on the night of 9/11, which suggests they had foreknowledge. So these events are happening that shape the society and the culture, and it's not totalitarianism in the old sense, but it's very much a totalitarian framework in the sense that the government is running our minds. The government is shaping how we think, and we are not free, and we have to break off these shackles.
Very well said. All right, Lance, thank you very much for being a guest.
Thank you. Thank you, Lynn. Thanks very much.
Okay, we'll talk to you again soon. By the way, are you working on a new book? Anything in there?
I am going out. There's a conference in San Francisco, and I'm meeting with some colleagues. There's a small group of us who have been writing about these matters in academia. It's a little different in the academy. You have this peer review process, and it can be a gauntlet to get things published, and it's not been easy. I could tell you stories about some of the things that have happened. But there's a group of us, and we meet, and we're talking about the new research agenda for us. And yeah, I am thinking about a book on cover-ups specifically and how they work. And the basic idea is to do what I did with the State Crimes Against Democracy, where I looked at these events and compared them, the timing, the targets, who benefited, and you can draw these connections and see a lot that way. And I thought, well, you know, cover-ups are something that we realize are connected to these events, but I don't think that they've been analyzed as a particular form of these kinds of crimes. So they're crimes, they're cover-ups, they're accessories after the fact of the crimes. And I think that they have some particular characteristics to them. I think also the government learns over time. You know, if you look at the Warren Commission report, they talk specifically about conspiracy and the possibility of conspiracy, and they deny it. They say it didn't happen, but they do discuss it. If you read the 9/11 Commission, there is no discussion of the possibility of that being an inside crime or even the possibility of there being explosives or incendiary devices in the Twin Towers.
Or Building 7, right?
Or Building 7. Nothing, not a word mentioned. And so, you know, I think part of what's happened is they're learning how to manipulate the culture, and part of it is they're learning how to cover up these events. And one thing they do is now they're just completely silent about it. I think assassination tactics changed over time. That you had rifle shot from a distance, and then handguns, and then plane crashes are more likely. So I want to look at the cover-ups in a way, in a systematic way. I think that's mainly what I bring to the table, is a comparative contrast approach to these events and looking at them as serial crimes where you have somebody in the background, an agency, a group of people, whatever you want to call them, a network, who are learning over time. And we're being stalked by these people, and they've become very, very effective at what they do. We're convinced that, we're told that all these things that appear to be developing over time are unrelated. I call that the coincidence theory. I've heard that elsewhere, but I think it's a good term to say, you know, you don't like conspiracy theory? I don't like coincidence theories. And particularly if you look at statistics, the more coincidences you have, the less likely that that is a true coincidence, that there's not something going on in the background. So part of what I want to do is look at these things, maybe cover-ups is a good topic, systematically, and put them all out on the table at once and build a little data set. I'm also looking at the language. The Ngram, Google Ngram search is a great tool, and I've been tracking some terms related to, one of the things that interests me is the terms related to conspiracy theory. You know, it's okay to say the magic bullet theory. It's okay to say October surprise. It's okay to say false flag terrorism. But what you can't say is Johnson was approved the Kennedy assassination. You can't say the theory, but you can say these words associated with the theory. I find that fascinating. So I'm kind of interested in trying to understand how the language evolves and how we as citizens, so we're effectively fighting back. When you have the magic bullet theory, that's a counter term. You're deploying this. They called you a conspiracy theorist. You've got a term that derides their theory. They have a theory that there's one bullet and made all these things, magic bullet. So part of it is trying to understand the culture, the civic culture in more detail, and learning how to detect when the government is manipulating us. Because I think it's a lot more subtle than we think, a lot more insidious than we think. Like when they plan it. See, everybody knows the CIA does stuff and and influences the press. But look at the conspiracy theory concept. They planted a term that was extremely powerful, extremely effective, and we didn't even hardly notice it. Even today, 50 years later, we're just coming to grips with this and starting to recognize it and deal with it. I think they did the same thing with 9/11 and with the term. And so part of what I'm wanting to do is study their methods. And it's like becoming a high crime detective, learning to detect these things, learning how, you know, what the various types of crime are that they conduct, who their targets are, what their methods are, how they learn, this kind of thing. So
right.
I got a long research agenda.
Well, we're catching up to what they've been doing. So it's all in the research and the education of knowing, you know, the problem, and then hoping that...
Yeah, until you recognize that it's going on, you don't even look.
And that was broadcast in May 2013. We're now going to hear from Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, and this is an interview by Cheryl from 9/11 Wake Up Call that was carried out in 2012.
I'm Cheryl. The interview you're about to hear with Dr. Paul Craig Roberts was originally aired in the fall of 2012, and here it is. Paul Craig Roberts has had careers in scholarship and academia, journalism, public service, and business. He's the chairman of the Institute for Political Economy, and he served under President Reagan as Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy from 1975 to 1978. He's also the author of 11 books. The latest one is called How the Economy Was Lost, The War of the Worlds, which came out in 2010. He has a website that is paulcraigroberts.org. He has an internet column that has attracted worldwide attention, and he has many, many articles there. And I'm going to just read you the titles of a few of them. Here goes. Is Washington deaf as well as criminal? The next election, high-stakes outcomes based on non-issues. Syria, Washington's latest war crime. The neocon war criminals in our midst. USA to continue its wars as long as dollar remains reserve currency. The message from both parties is that Americans are disposable. And then here's the title that drew me to ask him for an interview. It's called The 11th Anniversary of 9/11. I frequently read his articles, and he has long been a critic of the official conspiracy theory of what happened on 9/11. So, Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Could you tell our listening audience a little bit about your background in politics and in journalism?
Well, I was never exactly in politics. I was Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, which is a policy position. I was in the congressional staff, House and Senate, personal staffs, committee staffs. I was the associate editor of the Wall Street Journal, columnist for the Wall Street Journal, columnist for Business Week, the Scripps Howard News Service, Creators Syndicate. I had the William E. Simon Chair in Political Economy, the Center for Strategic and International Studies at Georgetown University. And for 25, 30 years, I was a senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University, held other academic appointments. And I've had some business experience. I ran a water company for 6 years. I've been an advisor to the major financial firms back when they were still honest, and other things of that sort.
That's quite an interesting background. Now, you just recently wrote an article for the Journal of 9/11 Studies called The 11th Anniversary of 9/11, and in it you state that there are only two things that one has to know about 9/11. And I wonder if you could share with the audience, what are those two things and why is that all we need to know?
Okay. The first thing that you need to know is that it's not possible, it's a fantasy, that the entire national security apparatus could so totally and completely fail as allegedly happened in the United States as a result of the 9/11 attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. The official story is as follows, that a few undistinguished, largely Saudi Arabian men, not backed by any government or by any intelligence service, managed to outwit not only the CIA, the FBI, the National Security Agency, which spies on the whole world, but all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies, including all intelligence agencies of America's NATO allies and Israel's Mossad, outwitted the National Security Council, NORAD, air traffic control, and somehow caused airport security to fail 4 times in 1 hour on the same morning. Now, this is a fantastic conspiracy theory. It gives these very undistinguished Arabs, who were the alleged hijackers, more powers than James Bond or V for Vendetta. These are superhuman-type creatures who can outwit everything that the national security state has in place and that protected us all these years from some sort of surprise attack from the Soviet Union. But it's not credible. It's too big of a failure. Nothing worked. They were successful in everything, so nothing worked. Well, this is not credible. If this is the case, then what do we have it for?
Mm-hmm. Did you know this early on?
Well, I was bothered by it from the start, but it didn't. It takes a while to realize that your own government might do something like that. You're not instantly out there. But let me get to the second point, and I'll get back to that question. The second thing you have to know is that if such a total failure of the national security state had occurred, immediately the White House, Congress, the media, would have been demanding a full investigation. How could this happen? Somebody would have been held accountable. there would have been screams for investigations and accountability as to how a few undistinguished people with no intelligence background or intelligence service helping them managed to so humiliate the United States in such a fantastic way. I mean, this is the greatest humiliation of a government in world history, much less of the world's only superpower. The president would have been saying, how did this happen? How can you look at the humiliation? We've been defeated by a few people like this. How can we be a superpower? And there would have been all kinds of hearings and accountability. Instead, the White House refused an investigation for a year or longer and finally gave in to the 9/11 families, which would, first of all, tried to buy them off, offering them huge sums of money to go away. Some of them took it, others refused. They finally had to have a political investigation. They appointed a commission that had no experts on it, and they fed them the information that the government wanted them to have and got more or less the government's story. Well, that's not credible either. You can't have this kind of a massive failure of national security and not have a real investigation of it. So that's really all you really need to know, that the government hasn't told the truth about that day. The reason I brought this up is that there's been a huge amount of investigations carried on by independent people, many of them first-class experts, you know, high-rise architects, structural engineers, physicists, nanochemists, and they've all been able to show scientifically that the three buildings in the World Trade Center did not come down the way the government said, that it defies the laws of physics, that it couldn't have happened in that way. And they've gotten into arguments with some of the people involved claiming it was nanothermite and others saying it was some kind of a controlled energy beam, some new super weapon. And so they get arguing about things and it starts sounding science fiction with controlled energy beams. And all of this is beside the point. You don't need to know any of that.
Right, so we can avoid all that arguing and just,
So that's just what I had to say about it, that you can't account for how the national security state can so totally fail, and you can't account for how, if it did, as the government says, there were not massive investigations and all kinds of people held accountable. And instead, we're given cock and bull story about a few Saudi Arabians who are more fantastic in their capabilities than all of the superheroes. So.
No, so we have all of these, the architects and engineers, we have a lot of the science that disproves the official story without a doubt. But why do you suppose that Congress and the media and even much of the public is just silent about this?
Well, the media can't say anything because it was concentrated during the Clinton years, and there's just a few firms now own the whole media. And the media is not run by journalists anymore. It's run by corporate advertising executives, and the value of the big mega companies that own the media is their broadcast licenses. And so if the government doesn't renew them, tens of billions of dollars of the company's shares are worth nothing. So they can't offend the government, and they can't offend advertisers, and they can't offend the public. And the public took me a while to face the fact that the government was capable of false flag events in order to pursue an agenda that it would not be able to get by the people without a new Pearl Harbor. So the media is useless, it's hopeless, it's impotent, it can't serve as an investigative agency, and it hasn't for years. And the Congress, the attack was so stunning, and immediately, of course, the question was revenge. And the people wanted revenge, and this was very clever, the way the neoconservatives and Cheney played it. Who was accountable was not those who failed to protect us, but the superheroes. So the whole focus instantly was shifted not to finding out what happened, how it happened, but to revenge on the alleged party, and that was said to be Bin Laden. So what could the Congress do? I mean, if a congressman had stood up and said, now, wait a minute, they would have said, oh, he's on the side of the enemies of America. So, and a few did vote against the wars that sprung out of this. But for the most part, members of Congress would have seen that as a losing position, that they would have been damned as supporting those who had attacked the United States. So they couldn't do anything. And now, of course, it's too late because they can't possibly come in now and second-guess themselves after having wasted $6 trillion on wars against Muslims.
Right, and millions of people have died in the process.
Yeah. And many Americans are dead or maimed or mentally disturbed from the service. So they're locked into it. And, of course, Obama and the Democrats are locked into it, just like the Republicans. This was a Republican enterprise, this 9/11 business, but Obama refused to hold anybody accountable for anything. And he gave them all a pass. Pass for torture, pass for spying without warrants, a pass for...
And do you think that's because they all have the same puppet master, so to speak?
That's what I think. They all have the same puppet masters, and this agenda serves the puppet masters. It produces huge profits for the military security complex that President Eisenhower warned us about maybe, what, half a century ago about. And it suits the Israel lobby. It eliminates countries in the Middle East that are capable of getting in Israel's way, at least to some extent, or who are capable of supplying Hezbollah, which successfully blocks Israel's efforts to occupy southern Lebanon. So it serves that. It's a very powerful lobby. Serves their interests. Serves the security state's interests. You know, the CIA's got power and have this new police state called Homeland Security. It serves the doctrine of the unitary executive, you know, the Republican doctrine that the president in wartime has powers that are not accountable to law or the Constitution. That's something the Federalist Society's been working on since the 1980s. So there are a lot of agendas that are served by this, and of course now even... And it even serves the left wing, because the left wing like the argument that the Muslim terrorists did this because it's an example of blowback. It shows that we so mistreat these people and colonize them and all that, that they have revolted and struck back at us. And this is very emotionally satisfying to many people on the left wing, that finally somebody stood up to us and gave us what we deserved. And, you know, we could go on, but there's all kinds of agendas that are served by it. So now it's sort of a story in place, despite the fact that there's no evidence for it.
Right. That's the curious piece, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, you know, there are also these psychological explanations. Many of them were presented at the Toronto hearings.
Yes, I went to those hearings. Yeah. It was quite interesting. Yeah.
And the psychological explanations are very cogent and clear, that people, just some things in reality people can't accept. It's too disturbing.
In your article, you also talk about Osama bin Laden's death in December of 2001, and then his useful death again in 2011. Could you talk a little bit about Osama bin Laden's role, if any, in 9/11, and then about his death?
Well, Osama bin Laden, according to him, had no role whatsoever in 9/11. The last video that is extant, that experts agree is bin Laden, was right after 9/11, and he said that he had nothing to do with it, that he was not opposed to the American people, had nothing against the American people, that he opposed the American government's colonial practices and the rule over Muslim countries, and he didn't like the cultural implications imported into Islam from the debauched American culture, but he didn't have anything against Americans and had nothing to do with this. Now, I believe him, because if he had had anything to do with it, he would have been bragging, because this is the way you build a movement. In fact, I'm surprised he didn't claim credit for it, even though he... because if you're trying to build a movement, an opposition movement or a revolutionary movement or attract terrorists, you want to claim, look, I've laid the great Satan low. Look what we've done. And that would just pull people to you. You see what I mean? It's a sign of your power. Now, I can remember back in the Cold War period, there would be terrorist events in Europe, Italy, for example, and we were all told it was the Red Brigades and something, but 3, 4, 5 groups would claim credit. And it later turned out from the Italian hearings that all these terrorists events were conducted by the CIA and intelligence. And they were designed to stop people from voting communist. And so the groups claiming credit were all CIA front groups.
But that's rich, isn't it?
It is rich, but But still, you know, it shows that the United States government understands that a terrorist group would be claiming credit. Well, so he didn't. So that's kind of a dead giveaway. I think the other giveaway is that if they were able to pull off something like that, they wouldn't have stopped with that.
Right.
But there's not been anything else. So, in other words, it would have happened all over, repeatedly. And there's so many soft targets in the United States, even still today. And this is why you can see that the terrorist threat is a hoax, because not a single thing has happened except the things the FBI organizes.
You're referring to, like, the underwear bomber and those
well,
things?
Well, I'll get to that. But like here, they every now and then they claim, oh, there's a terrorist group. Remember, there was one that was going to blow up the Sears Tower.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out there were a few, well, they're just, I guess, mentally disturbed people, and they were rounded up by the FBI and paid money to be part of a plot. The whole idea came from the FBI, and the organization came from the FBI. So if they were real terrorists, you wouldn't have the FBI out. They call these sting operations. You wouldn't have the FBI out having to do all of this because they'd have their hands full. And just look at the airport security thing. It's pointless if there's real terrorists because they wouldn't try to go through the machines. They would get in those massive lines. For example, you go through Atlanta Airport in the afternoon, the line waiting to get in to go through the security would be 500 people in it. You'd get in there and set your bomb off there. There's no way they can screen you before they can screen you.
Right. Right, and that would do more damage than an airplane.
It would do far more damage. It would give the American authorities an insoluble problem. You've got to screen people before you screen them. How did you do that? And, of course, there's the shopping centers, and there's all these electric substations everywhere that are just unguarded. If you drive along the roads, you see them. Just sit. And an attack on those, there's no way to prevent it. It could shut down the energy supply in a third of the country without any trouble. And the simplest thing of all would be for them just to drive along in the rush hour traffic in New York and Washington and Atlanta, Dallas, Los Angeles, and just throw out boxes of roofing nails. You would have tens of thousands of cars, flat tires, and choked all the freeways. It would take weeks to clear it out.
Right.
But nothing has happened. So the number of soft targets, as I said, is massive, and none of them have been hit. It's been 11 years, and not a single thing has happened. Now, the underwear bomber, the shoe bomber, the shampoo and bottle of water bomber, these are not credible. They're not credible because it's not credible that if Al-Qaeda pulled off 9/11, they would be resorting to such comic and ineffective means. It certainly wouldn't be relying on lighting a shoe bomb or underwear bomb with a match. The guy would take out his cell phone or his laptop, push a button, and there we go. So it's so primitive to try to sell something like that to people after you've said, oh, look, they've destroyed 3 World Trade Center towers. They destroyed the Pentagon. You can't have superheroes and then reduce them to comic characters.
Yet the public falls for that.
Yeah, they fall for it because no one says, wait a minute. I think if we had a media that said, oh, this is ridiculous, and people might say, oh, yes, I see what you mean. But they don't get that opportunity. They can't think for themselves, but if somebody thinks for them, they can see sometimes, or some of them can. Now, the real giveaway is the underwear bomber, because this person had no passport, and the airlines refused to board him. And so this is on Christmas Day on a flight going to Detroit. And the airline say, no, can't board you, no passport. I mean, you couldn't do that long before there was any terror. The airline wasn't going to send you to a country that couldn't accept you because you didn't have a passport.
Right.
I mean, even in my day, you couldn't do that. You couldn't get on an international flight without a passport or a visa or something. This guy has nothing. So this official appears who walks him on the plane. Well, what kind of official has the authority to override all the rules in place? I don't know who that official is. And an official with that kind of authority would know full well that the guy is going to be rejected when the plane lands in Detroit. He's not going to be allowed in. He's got no passport. He can't get through passport control. They're going to send him right back. So what was the point of it? The anomaly is you've got someone with the authority to override all the operating rules and put somebody on a plane without a passport, and yet assumed this guy with all his authority didn't know that the person on the plane without a passport wouldn't be accepted and would be sent back. So it's a pointless exercise. And so obviously it was intended for this person to be on the airplane. And of course, it wasn't a bomb. There's been no evidence ever presented that this was anything more than firecracker powders. But again, if you look at the amazing feat of 9/11 that's ascribed to bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, and then you look at the pitiful comic things, they don't match. They don't go together.
And I'm assuming that my guess is that the government is doing that to keep us in fear so that we do think that there's this threat out there ongoing?
Yeah, it keeps fear. Of course, they make, you know, Chertoff, the first Homeland Security director, has made a fortune selling all of the scanning materials to the Transportation Safety Administration. So that it lets them sell the machines. It lets them keep the fear alive that we're under attack, and then they use that to erode the civil liberties. I mean, that's how they took away habeas corpus, due process, and now even your right to life, because they can now shoot you down and say, oh, well, we think he's a terrorist. So it let them gain unaccountable power. And, of course, that's what the German Nazi, Goebbels, I think it was, or Goering, one of them, at the Nuremberg trial said, look, all you have to do is tell the people they're being attacked, and that generates fear, and then you can do whatever you want. And that's how we took over the German state. Well, that's happened here. That's exactly what's happened here.
Getting back to Osama bin Laden and his recent death in Pakistan, what do you think of that?
Well, I think it was it's a hoax, and it was done because Obama was sinking in the polls, and there was fear that the Democrats themselves might run a candidate against him for the nomination. And he and his people didn't want that. So they said, what can we do? We can make him a hero. He'll kill bin Laden. Now, bin Laden couldn't have possibly still been alive. We know that in October of 2001, he was undergoing kidney dialysis. And in December of 2001, there were widespread reports, also from our own government, that he had died. So no one that needs kidney dialysis is going to live on the run for 10 years. And at the alleged compound in Pakistan, there was no sign of any kidney dialysis machine or any other kind of medical, no doctors. And the most stunning thing is, if this is the mastermind of the world's most dangerous terrorist movement, like Rumsfeld and Cheney and everybody said, would they leave him unguarded?
Right.
Nobody there but two women? This is nonsensical. It's not believable. And since he was unarmed, why would they kill him?
Right.
This is the mastermind. You can find out everything. And if you did kill him, wouldn't you at least want to show that you had killed him? No, we dumped him in the ocean somewhere.
In the middle of the night.
In the middle of the night. So how can anybody believe such an absurd,
that is incredible,
concocted lie? I can't understand how anybody could fall for that. But I guess people, maybe it satisfies them. Oh, we finally got the guy who did this to us. And they're happy.
Yeah, maybe they want to believe it. Yeah,
they want to believe it. That's what happens then.
So how do you respond to it when people claim that if some part of the U.S. government had been involved in 9/11, somebody would have talked about it by now?
Well, in many ways. First of all, it's not true. For example, in 1967, the Israelis attacked the USS Liberty. They either killed or wounded the majority of the crew, failed to sink the ship, and the United States government covered it up. I mean, the whole story is known now. It's all out and known. And they told the survivors in a very threatening way, don't mention this, don't you dare say a word about this. And it was 12 years before one of the surviving officers on the ship wrote the story and told it. And it was back in the 80s or 90s when Admiral Tom Morrow, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who failed ever to get the government to acknowledge it, finally convened on his own. The commission consisted of him, the former chief legal officer of the United States military, and one of the ambassadors who had heard all the radio transmissions and knew all about it. And they documented the story, and still the government won't. And even if somebody says something, they just say, oh, he's lost his mind.
Right.
Or he's a conspiracy kook. Or they just don't pay attention. They just ignore it.
Right, the media doesn't give it any attention.
It just doesn't get reported. And look, we've got 110 of the first responders. These are firemen who are in the buildings, policemen. They were the building maintenance people. And they report hearing numerous explosions all over the building from top to bottom, including in the sub-basements. And this is documented. It has no effect. So, in my own opinion, literally everybody involved could stand up and said, we did it. And somebody would say, oh, it's just a joke.
They're not going to let anything out that doesn't agree with the official story at this point.
Well, I think they can let it out now. It just wouldn't be believed.
So, in your article, you also state that most Americans are too mentally and emotionally weak to be able to come to grips with the truth.
Yeah.
Could you talk a bit more about that? I know you've touched on it a little bit, but maybe you could tell us more about that.
Well, that's based on reading all of the reports from psychologists about how people can't deal with things. But I see it myself. I've got a lot of friends. I've got 130 IQs, successful people, lawyers, and they just can't admit that their worst enemy is their own government. It's just too discomforting. And it shatters their whole worldview about how things work. And their notion is, we have to get this group, we have to get that, we have to use the government, we have to get them, we have to get that. But if the government is actually not on your side, all of your hopes and illusions and worldview just falls apart. So all the enemies they want to get, they can't get. They can't get the towel heads, they can't get the poor, they can't get the welfare queens, they can't. The things that they've been worked up about all their life, if the government is not on their side, how are they going to get all these things they've been worked up about all their life? So I think on the whole that this is a sign of extreme mental weakness and emotional weakness.
It's a large leap to make from our original beliefs, the myths about America, to what's really happening.
Yeah, and we've been propagandized in them so thoroughly. I mean, the Cold War is what let the government take over people's minds, because here we had this the Soviet evil, nuclear annihilation hanging over our head, and Washington put on the white hat and wore it for half a century, and it's very successful propaganda.
You've just been listening to the first part of an interview with Dr. Paul Craig Roberts. You can learn more about him and read his articles at the website paulcraigroberts.org.
And I would supplement the analysis of Paul Craig Roberts there by pointing out money. You didn't think I would go a whole show without mentioning money, did you? Although it does many other things as well, is a very potent force at encouraging mental and moral weakness, a refusal to take a stand and do what's right because it's right. And just today, I went past a plastic sphere full of old coins and notes with the explanation, fight cancer. Considering what we know about, for example, how the chemical industries are invested in the cancer treatment business, the assumption that if you're putting that metal disc in a plastic box somewhere along the line, this will help fight cancer, I consider to be deeply suspect. This show and all previous episodes are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. I hope this show has helped you to prepare for a barrage of misinformation about the JFK assassination as we approach the 50th anniversary in November.
By unwelcome travelers and other brave